Hey everyone, and welcome back to your Linux and open source news podcast. I'm your host Nick, and this is the weekly show where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, or open web space for the week. So in this episode, we have a bunch of stuff. First, the Cosmic Desktop Alpha will be delayed. We won't see it at the end of March as initially planned. Second, Front suffered a massive data breach with social security numbers for 43 million French citizens being grabbed by malicious actors. We also got the release of the Linux kernel 6.8. We have a discussion on the number of bugs being reported against Plasma 6. We have some good news in the EU for how open source will be considered with a new set of laws. We also have the EU investigating itself for how it handles data. We have OpenAI's ridiculous defense against the New York Times in their lawsuit. And we have a bunch more. So as always, if you want to reference the sources that I use to create this show, all the links are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show to help it keep going, then you can also click one of the links in the description of the show. If you become a Patreon member or a YouTube member at any tier, you will get a daily version of that podcast. So definitely check that out if you don't want to wait for the end of the week to get the news. So now let's get started with the episode. So the Cosmic Desktop Alpha will be pushed back. It was initially planned to be released around the end of March, but it will now come in late May instead, because they apparently want to make sure that all the core apps that they ship reach the minimal viable product stage. So basically something that actually works and has the minimum required set of features to be a useful application, instead of pushing an alpha where the desktop only relies on half-baked applications. There will also be a second alpha a bit later after some testing has been done. So I guess it comes from a good place, meaning that yes, they do want to provide an alpha that actually works instead of having first impressions being based on a very limited set of features. Now, they still have some progress to talk about. First, hybrid graphics support is now completed for Cosmic. You get an applet to let you see which apps are using the dedicated GPU, and you can close these specific applications so the GPU is no longer used and you can save battery life. They also implemented minimizing and restoring windows, something that not all desktops have. And these windows will apparently be placed in a dedicated applet in the dock. So it kind of reminds me of how macOS does things by default, where when you minimize an application, it doesn't minimize into the app's icon in the dock. It goes into a specific place on the right of the dock with a little thumbnail preview of the actual window you minimized. So I think it's a pretty good solution, even though I personally prefer minimizing to the app's icon. The tiling applet is also complete, letting users enable auto-tiling either for the workspace you're currently using or for all workspaces. Input device settings have also been implemented with features like tap to click, edge scrolling, or touchpad acceleration, plus selecting the input sources and changing the keyboard shortcuts. What remains is to implement drag and drop in the terminal to get a file path, for example, plus a confirmation dialog before closing a terminal window if you have a process running, because you don't want to shut that down accidentally. The text editor also needs to get spell checking and session restore features before it's ready, and the Cosmic File Manager is progressing nicely. And interestingly, it's also the first app that they've shown that has a regular old menu bar with the file, edit, and whatever other menus. So it's not going to be all GNOME-style apps with a header bar or KDE-style apps with a hamburger menu. You're getting these old menu bars in there, which also potentially opens the door for a potential global menu bar applet at some point, which would be cool. Cosmic will also support the desktop portal for dark mode and accent colors. And on top of that, the current Pop Shop, which is loosely based on Elementary OS's App Center, will be replaced by a brand new application developed in Rust, as with the rest of the Cosmic desktop, which will be called the Cosmic Store. It's apparently very fast to open and to search for applications, and it will also support Flatpak, of course. So I'm a bit sad to see that the alpha is being delayed. I had a video planned at the end of March to talk about this, but I guess I will replace it with something else. I also prefer having a solid first alpha that has all the planned features, rather than having something that wouldn't really be a good representation of what to expect in Cosmic. So it's probably for the best. That's why I generally don't do reviews for alphas. I stick to either betas or release candidates, because alphas tend to lack a lot of the features that you will get in the final version, and so this review of an alpha is generally super outdated by the time the real version comes out. Now, France, the country where I live, also got a giant data breach this week. Data from 43 million French citizens was grabbed by malicious actors. It's data that comes from the unemployment databases, which includes anyone who ever reported to be unemployed to get access to unemployment benefits, or anyone who wanted to access training for a career change, or even just at a short period where they were in between jobs. And this data dates back 20 years, and it includes things like email addresses, social security numbers, phone numbers, dates of birth, and complete names. So it is ripe for fraud and identity theft. And it could also be linked and cross-referenced with other data grabbed in other breaches to build even more comprehensive profiles and identities. It is a huge problem, and apparently it was accomplished through social engineering. And the affected French service will now have to inform everyone that was affected, so expect 43 million emails to be sent. I think I'm probably in there as well. I never reported to unemployment services because I never really needed it, fortunately, but it still might contain some data from a summer job I did back in the day, for example. Now, another problem is, why is that data dating back 20 years? Because French laws are pretty strict for data conservation, and generally, it's 10 years maximum. So I guess it is mainly to have all the data required to calculate pensions when you retire, because it is also calculated using the periods where you were unemployed. But it's still pretty bad. Now, second, these French public services really, really need better training to handle social engineering attacks. And people there also need a serious cybersecurity threat assessment. It is unacceptable that citizens' data can be grabbed like that. No system is bulletproof, no software, no human is bulletproof. But in what world would anyone give access to this type of data, or the database, or the software containing the data, to anyone over the phone or a simple email? Even if they masquerade as someone from higher French instances, this should not be part of the process. Now, all in all, it means most French citizens will have to take a look at their various accounts for French public services to change their passwords and to be very, very wary of anything happening in other places that might require their social security number. In France, we don't use social security numbers all that much to log in to various services, but they are still used for some things like healthcare, for example, so there is some pretty scary potential there. Now, last week we got the Linux kernel version 6.8. It is not as big an update as 6.7, but it's still a pretty big one. It includes the new experimental Intel Xe driver that will replace the i915 kernel driver for recent Intel GPUs, integrated or dedicated. The kernel also improves support for upcoming AMD hardware, and that's for CPUs and GPUs. There's also better support for the Raspberry Pi 5, notably on the graphics side of things. And the ZSwap subsystem is now able to get rid of old or cold pages from the RAM when you really need that RAM available for something else. The kernel can also prevent direct write to block devices that have a mounted file system to prevent this file system being corrupted. The Intel CPU frequency scaling system will also be much better for recent Intel CPUs. It's now able to reliably hit their max boost speeds on Linux, when before it was limited to something a little bit under that. And Ryzen 7000 CPUs also got a fix to avoid radio frequency interference from the Wi-Fi and the GPU memory clocks. Running multiple TCP concurrent connections will also be much faster, up to 40% faster, and you will also get support for the Nintendo Switch Online controllers, a few other gamepads and handhelds, and also color management on the Steam Deck. So as I said, it's a smaller update than 6.7, but it still contains some good stuff, especially the potential future Intel Xe driver, which should improve things a lot for Intel GPUs. The 6.8 will apparently be the kernel used in Ubuntu 24.04, and likely in Fedora 40 as well, so it is an important one because a lot of people will be stuck with that one for a while. Now, on top of that, the kernel 6.9 is also seeing some work, and there are some good changes in there as well. Support for AMD's preferred core is finally being added, meaning that Linux will be able to place the most demanding workloads on the fastest core of your specific Ryzen CPU, because all CPUs are not created equal. Sometimes some cores just run higher, and AMD knows that and flags these cores as being the highest performers. And so Linux will be able to use these to get the maximum speeds for specific workloads. The Intel Xe driver will also receive further work. Intel Fast Boot will be enabled on all hardware that supports it, and Fuse Pass-Through was implemented to improve I/O performance for all Fuse file systems that you might have mounted. The old NTFS driver will also finally be removed because it's been replaced by the solid NTFS 3G driver, or NTFS 3, not sure which one is which, so it will just be better for NTFS users to only use that one. And there will be better case-insensitive folder and file handling, which should lead to better performance. Now we need to talk about KDE Plasma 6, because KDE developers are currently seeing something from 150 to 200 new bug reports per day since the release of Plasma 6, compared to the 30 to 50 that they saw before that. And the KDE developers are keen to point out that this doesn't mean that Plasma is just as buggy as it was a few years ago, because there are a few things to consider. First, not all bugs are equal. Some can be a slightly misaligned control, a typo in a translation, or a missing icon, and some can be desktop breaking. 150 bugs doesn't mean 150 people reported they cannot use their desktop at all. And that's also not counting duplicates. This is the number of bug reports before triage. So Nate Graham says that out of all these bugs, most aren't even linked to KDE in itself. They are reports against graphics drivers, against themes, against third-party apps, and the like. And many are duplicates, or they are very exotic issues linked to a very specific combination of settings that just aren't on by default. You still need to fix those, but they are not major bugs that impact everyone. They also say that most of the significant bugs that prevent people from using the desktop are now fixed or have merge requests open to fix them. Now, the second thing is, the more bugs are reported, the more stable the desktop becomes. It's proof that KDE Plasma 6 is being used a lot and is improving. It still means that there are bugs to fix, but it's also an indication of popularity. Now third, this all stems from the volume of options and configurations in KDE. The more you let users do and tweak, the more chances things have to break or to be buggy. And as Nate Graham says it, bug-free software can exist, but it's a lot more likely to happen with software that severely restricts what you can do, which is absolutely not the goal of KDE. So, to conclude, yes, Plasma 6 does have bugs, just like every other desktop. But a simple number of bugs doesn't really tell the whole story either. From my experience and from a lot of other people who reported on Plasma 6, it is undeniably more stable and more polished than the previous major releases were. It is definitely not perfect. I've seen a lot of comments reporting problems, especially with the Wayland section and X-Wayland, but it is still much better than the previous major versions when they were released. Now, I still don't use Plasma 6 myself because my distro of choice, TuxedoOS, hasn't released it. They've announced that it's coming, they are currently testing it, but it's not there yet, so I'm not using it as a daily driver. I might revise my opinion when I get all these updates and I start encountering bugs myself, especially since I do run Wayland and I do play games that require X Wayland for now. So maybe I will finally think that KDE Plasma 6 is super buggy, but in my experience and testing from the first RC to my review, it really was very stable. Now we're going to talk about the European Union, not the Digital Markets Act or Apple or whatever, because that's not what interests us today, we already covered that at length. But we have to talk about the Cyber Resiliency Act. On paper, this was a solid set of regulations that were meant to force companies to follow procedures to ensure that their software was secure before offering it to users, with a bunch of checks and certifications to follow if you wanted your software to be eligible to be marketed as something secure or even to be used by certain institutions. This was probably a good thing for big companies that sell software, but it was a terrible thing for open source projects that would basically be incapable of following any of these regulations or even afford the audits and the certifications that they would need. The other issue would be that open source developers under this Cyber Resiliency Act would be held liable if anyone using their software suffered from various attacks, even though open source licenses generally absolve developers from responsibility of this type, well, they would still be held liable for damages and problems. So, obviously, it was something that would have made open source software very undesirable for a lot of companies, because, well, first, open source software would not have passed the certifications necessary, so maybe companies wouldn't even have been able to use that open source software. But it was also a terrible thing for open source developers because it meant that basically they could get sued for anyone using their software, not maintaining it, and attacking them because, hey, this is still a supported version, this bug hasn't been fixed, so you're liable for the damages. So the Free Software Foundation campaigned within the EU to try and get an exemption for open source and free software. And it looks like they managed to get it. Free software will apparently have a broad exemption from this set of laws. And it also looks like the liability will lie with companies who significantly benefit financially from the software. Meaning, for example, you develop an open source library, a big company decides to use it in a commercial product. If they suffer a massive breach or a problem, since they're the ones benefiting financially from this library, then they're the ones who are liable because it was their task to ensure that the software they shipped was actually up to the task. And if not, they should have contributed and fixed problems. So it's a very interesting development because on the one hand, it might make companies really wary of using open source software that isn't backed by a major company. Because if they do so, they will have to take on a risk. They're shipping a library. If they don't review its code, if they don't contribute to it, they might be liable for damages stemming from vulnerabilities in those libraries. But on the other hand, it also means open source software can keep going as it was, freely available without regulatory burdens. Now, I guess since companies already used open source software without any guarantees in the past, it might not make much of a difference after this law is passed in the EU, but it's still an interesting development, and kudos to the Free Software Foundation. I'm generally very critical of them because you don't really see them doing much, but this was an important job and they managed to do it, so props to them. Now, still on the EU, in a pretty funny retro circle of investigation, the EU is investigating itself over data privacy and the use of big tech services. The EU Data Protection Commission found that the European Commission, the organism that generally regulates big tech companies, was in breach of data transfer rules, because it turns out the European Commission uses Microsoft 365, and there are absolutely no safeguards in place to make sure that the data the app collects is not transmitted to servers outside of the EU, which is a big no-no when it comes to privacy in the EU. The data has to be stored in the EU, or there has to be a specific data transfer agreement that restricts what the company can do with the data if it's stored outside of the EU. So the European Data Protection Supervisor said that the EU really did not specify which types of data was collected by Microsoft 365 and for which purpose. So the Commission now has to apply corrective measures by December 9th, 2024, or they have to stop using Microsoft's cloud suite entirely. So for now, all data flows between the European Commission and Microsoft servers must be stopped, and they will have to do some data mapping to see exactly what is collected, what goes out of their use of this solution, and where it goes exactly, which means they will have to work with Microsoft to know more about that. And they will also have to fix the contracts that they have with Microsoft to ensure that these include all the necessary safeguards for this EU data to be limited only to what's absolutely necessary for the service to run. Now, the European Commission agreed to review all of this, but they also said that compliance will undermine their current level of services and IT, since this applies to Microsoft products, but also to other potential services that they might use. And maybe it's time someone told the European Commission that they could use a bunch of other services for an organism that regularly hits big tech companies on the head for their abuse of data and their privacy breaches. It's pretty funny to see them using a software that just basically doesn't respect privacy at all without any safeguards. We do have EU-based solutions that do the exact same job as Microsoft 365 for cheaper, that are open source, and that are private by default. Maybe it's time we stopped considering that Microsoft is the only solution for cloud storage and Office suites. This hasn't been the case for ages, and alternatives are just as solid. So, European Commission, you cannot use one of your hands to hit big tech company over the head for abusing their power, and use the other hand to give them money to use their services without any safeguards. Put your money where your mouth is and start using services that follow the principles you're trying to impose on everyone. Now let's talk a little bit about AI. You might be aware of the lawsuit currently in process between the New York Times and OpenAI, where the former accuses the latter of scrapping their articles to train their AI without any authorization or compensation. The New York Times ran some prompts and found out that ChatGPT can just spit out entire portions of their articles or entire articles, and they used that fact to sue OpenAI. And OpenAI's defense is pretty weird, because their only statement right now is that they're saying the media hired people to craft specific prompts to get ChatGPT to reproduce articles, and that people would never land on these results on their own. And the New York Times agrees. They're saying that, yes, they just copy-pasted a few sentences of their own articles as a ChatGPT prompt. But they also say that the defense just doesn't work. Yes, it's not a prompt that people would reasonably type. But also, that's not at all what the lawsuit is about. No matter how you reach the state where ChatGPT reproduces an entire New York Times article, what matters for the lawsuit is that the article is indeed reproduced, which proves OpenAI used it to train their AI, and they didn't get permission to do that. So I don't know what OpenAI's lawyers hoped to accomplish here, but that's the weakest defense I've ever seen. It's like being accused of forgery and trying to deny the claim by saying that the forgery isn't really easy to notice. It doesn't work. Now, whether courts take the case and whether they conclude that training an AI does need permission from the original author is something else entirely. But OpenAI just cannot make that case disappear by saying the prompts that were used to prove they scrap articles were not prompts that people would actually type. The fact remains that ChatGPT is able to spit out entire articles and thus has been trained on them, which is what the New York Times is suing them for. So you just cannot dismiss the case on this basis. You're basically confirming what the New York Times is accusing you of, which is dumb. Now let's talk about emulation, and it seems like Nintendo's attack on the Yuzu emulator has had wide repercussions on the entire emulation world, as a lot of developers are now stepping down or changing how they promote their tools. So first, Cytra, the DS and 3DS emulator, is now gone. It was part of the deal the Yuzu developers made with Nintendo, because, well, they also developed that specific emulator. Pizza Boy, which is an emulator for GBA and Game Boy Color, is also gone. Drastic, a DS emulator, went free instead of paid, and will probably be removed in the future as well. Strato, which is another Switch emulator, just lost its main developer. Dynarmic, a tool to speed up various emulators, ended development entirely. A contributor to Ryujin X, another Switch emulator, has stepped down. And Ether SX2, which is a PS2 emulator, is also gone after they had already suspended development a year ago. Now, other emulators are obviously still active. They're saying they have solid legal grounds to stand on, and those are probably emulators that target consoles that are no longer sold, with games that are not purchasable anymore in any way. But Nintendo definitely scared people away from working on an emulator. Even the forks of Yuzu that are popping up are making it more difficult to use, as they now require you to bring all the various decryption keys and the firmware from your own Switch, instead of trying to replicate this firmware or to break the keys in the emulator itself. A lot of emulators are also no longer paywalling anything or even asking for donations, to remove the aspect that they would be profiting from this work, and that could be used against them in a lawsuit. So all in all, it did have a big effect, even though there was no court ruling. It was settled out of the courts. But just no one has the money to fight Nintendo's army of lawyers, or even any company's army of lawyers for that matter. And no one wants to have to settle to pay millions of dollars. It is still a really bad thing for gaming in general, because emulators are just the only way to ensure conservation of games, even after their publishers have gone under or they stopped offering a way to play those games on any legally available platforms. And if we lose emulation and these game conservation efforts, we will also lose an entire part of the medium's history, which is obviously a very bad thing. Okay, now let's talk about apps now. And first, we got the Proton Mail desktop client for Linux. It was released for Windows and macOS in early access a few weeks back, and it now came to our OS of choice as well. The desktop app seems to be mostly the webmail encapsulated as a desktop client with added native notifications and support for dark mode, and of course all the features of the webmail because it is basically the webmail. Now unfortunately, it is not free. It is for now limited to people with a paid plan. You can try it out for 14 days for free, but after that you will have to pay, which is disappointing. The Linux version is still in beta, and it only comes as a deb or an RPM, so there's no Flatpak or app image to support all other distros. I talked about this with Proton's CEO in an interview I did a few months ago, you can find it in this exact podcast, and they said they mainly wanted to work on their own desktop client, because while Proton Bridge exists to use your account on other tools, it also means Proton is bound to how well these clients support standard email protocols. We have the example of Outlook, who turned off certain IMAP and SMTP authentication methods, meaning that Bridge cannot work with the latest versions of Outlook, and there's nothing Proton can do about it. So I have a few gripes with this client. First, I really want them to offer the app in more universal formats, so you don't have to use an unofficial third-party repackaged build using the deb as its base on a distro that doesn't support debs or RPMs. I want an official Flatpak or an app image or even a snap. Second, I hope Bridge stays alive for the email clients that can work with it, like Thunderbird. And third, it would probably be better if Bridge and the desktop mail client were accessible to everyone and not just paid users. I understand that they need to have features that are limited to paid users, they are a business and they're not taking external investment, they're just funding themselves through their sales. But having access to a desktop client should probably be free for everyone, after all the mobile apps for iOS and Android are available for everyone even if you only have a free plan. And yes, disclaimer, Proton is a regular sponsor of my YouTube channel, but it doesn't mean I cannot express wishes or criticisms against some of the things they do. Now, still on the topic of apps, Krita has a solid roadmap for 2024, but it also includes something that might make some people mad. The popular digital painting app published a list of what they hope to achieve this year, in 2024. And this includes a system to add speech bubbles for comics, with text nicely flowing into the bubbles and resizing itself to fit the available space. They also want to bring a new layer type for comic book frameworks. They want better integration with Blender, even though there's apparently a solid plugin out there already to do that. They want to replace the current Docker system with all their potential floating panels with something more flexible and something that is actually maintained by someone. And they also want to add a system to provide presets for the various tools that you have access to. Now, on the way are also a new interface to handle color palettes, and they want to add GPU acceleration to the transform mask to speed up the areas of the app that need it. They also pondered adding that to brushes, but apparently their brush performance is already pretty good, so they didn't feel the need to do that just yet. And finally, they're also asking the community what they think about AI-related features. Now, apparently, in the discussions that they had going on, artists said that generative AI is worthless and would just create bland templates. But artists also said that an AI assistant could be useful to improve certain tedious parts of the drawing workflow. So the Krita team started investigating things like AI-assisted inking for your sketches. This is basically the step where you redraw nice, crisp lines over your initial rough sketch to finalize the shape of what you actually drew. And it's apparently considered a bit tedious as you're just redrawing something that you already created. So it makes sense to have an AI tool that could do that for you and could let you change the end results afterward to make it really suit the vision that you had in mind. Now, the Krita team is not sure if this will actually happen, but they are looking into it. And to reassure people, they also confirmed that they would not use any AI tool that uses a model trained on images that were scrapped off the internet, because, well, that's just completely unethical. So it's a solid roadmap here. Personally, I am not an artist, I wouldn't be able to use half of what Krita offers, but it seems to be a very popular tool for artists, so seeing progress on that is always cool. Now, whether the AI features are interesting or not, I am not really in the know enough to say that. Like I'm saying, I'm not an artist, but I think striking the balance of having an AI assistant that helps you do a few things instead of having something spit out an end result for you is a good approach. I don't have a problem with AI as an assistive tool. I have a problem with AI as a creation tool, because obviously everything it does is based on other people's work that were never compensated or never contacted even to know if you could use that data. So that's mainly the ethical issue I have with that. But if it's an ethical AI assistant that is based on data that is freely available and that respects the licenses of this data, I don't really have an issue with it. Okay, and to conclude this episode, we have to talk about Valve and Epic. You probably know that these two companies don't necessarily like each other, and some internal emails that were disclosed as a result of a lawsuit from a publisher or game developer against Valve gave us some information about this ongoing dispute of Epic Games versus Valve. And apparently, Valve reached out to Tim Sweeney, the CEO of Epic, in 2017. To ask them what they did to annoy Epic, because Epic just started fighting Valve with their own store, striking exclusivity deals, buying some games and pulling them out of Steam, and just not bringing their own games to Steam anymore. So Epic obviously replied that they thought the 30% commission Valve charges is no longer justifiable, well, was no longer justifiable in 2017, because the R&D and the setup of the platform were already all paid for, and so charging 30% for just ongoing hosting and transactions was way too much. And I think it's totally fair to argue for that. It's too much when Apple or Google do it, and it's also too much when Valve does it. Now, Sweeney also attacked Valve on their decision to offer better rates to bigger publishers only, while small developers with less popular games were stuck with their 30% commission. Which, again, is a fair criticism. The terms should have been the same for everyone, and it was clearly a bid from Valve to retain the likes of EA, Ubisoft, and Epic on Steam, because all of these companies were moving to their own clients and were just not putting their games on Steam anymore. Now, internally, Valve seemed to mock Sweeney's criticism, with Valve's COO sending a "you mad bro" email to Gabe Newell, the CEO of Valve. And it's all a pretty stupid and crappy situation, really, because both companies have done good things and bad things. On the one hand, I do appreciate Valve's efforts towards Linux. They basically made Linux gaming a thing when it really wasn't, and they are also fervent supporters of Linux and of open source. Not everything they do is open source, but they do contribute a lot. They contributed a lot to Plasma, to AMD drivers, to the Linux kernel, and with Proton and Wine, they've done a lot. I also appreciate Epic's efforts to offer better terms to developers, and also their monthly free games policy. It's a marketing tool, but it still gives you free games. But we also need to remember that Valve is sort of gouging developers. 30% is very high as a commission rate, and it's been super high on any store that practices this commission. You might argue that, yes, the costs of Valve building up Steam and communicating on Steam and the R&D that they did back in the day is now fully paid for, and so it would be reasonable to lower this. Valve is making record profits every year off of Steam, and they're basically not even developing any games right now, so 30% could be considered way too high. And also, offering better rates only to big publishers is kinda crappy, because they're not the ones that need those better rates. But also, we need to remember that Epic is not a champion for consumers. They're parading as such, but they're only criticizing Valve publicly because they want to retain more money. Their own store is proof of that. They constantly snipe games off of Steam to put them exclusively on the Epic Game Store, and they don't treat those games right. For some pre-orders, they apply giant sales without even contacting the publisher, meaning that the publisher loses some money off of the pre-orders. And their own store is just there to make money for them, And all those exclusivity deals are preventing people from choosing the platform they prefer to get their games from and to play them on, which is especially nefarious for us Linux users, because if the game isn't on Steam, it's instantly more complicated to make it run on Linux. And also, ironically, these barriers put in place for people to not let them choose their platform is exactly what Epic is fighting Apple for on iOS. They're saying consumers should be free to choose the platform and the store, except that's not what they want. What they want is developers to be free to distribute their apps as they want, which is not exactly the same thing. On top of that, Epic has a very bad stance towards Linux in general. They refuse to provide the same tools Valve does for Linux gaming in their own client. Their own client doesn't even have a native Linux version. And they still will not enable their anti-cheat for Linux for the only game that is keeping the company afloat, which is Fortnite. So both companies, Valve and Epic, are just companies in this case. None of them are your friend. They are both here to make money. And I think we do need competition against Valve to have a real choice of platforms and to drive that commission rate down. But also, Valve is the only company supporting my operating system of choice and open source in general. Epic does not have the same amount of support for our platform and for open source as Valve has done. So for me, the choice is easy. I will buy my games on Steam, and if they're not available on Steam, I just will not play them. Doesn't mean that Valve is perfect. They are definitely not. But in my opinion, they're doing better by me as a Linux user as Epic ever did. Now, as soon as Epic Games brings their official client to Linux with a tool like Proton to run those games, then yeah, maybe I'll revise my position. But for now, Valve is the only gaming company that supports my OS of choice, and I have to give them props to that no matter what they do on the side. Okay, so this will complete this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you need more details on any of these topics, all the links are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show, all the links are in the show notes as well. As a reminder, if you become a Patreon member or a YouTube member at any tier starting at $1 a month, you will get a daily version of this show to be up to date with every single thing happening in a daily format. So thanks for listening, and I guess you will hear me in the next one next week. Bye!